Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Happy December 26th, no matter what you're celebrating. Today, we interview the interviewers, Tom Brokaw, Larry King, Jim Lehrer, no relation, and beginning with Christian Amanpour, host of the Sunday morning talk show ABC This Week, who just announced she will be leaving that job to return to her major interest, her lifelong love, covering foreign affairs for both ABC and CNN. Christiane and I talked earlier this month just before her job change was announced. I wished her happy holidays.
And the same to you and all your listeners. And it's wonderful to be back with you, Brian.
In terms of world history, Christiane, this is one of those years that'll go down as a turning point. In 1989, democracy swept across the communist world in Eastern Europe. You covered that for CNN. In 2011, across the Arab world, and with echoes even in the Western world. This is a pivotal year in history, don't you think?
I really do, Brian. It's remarkable. And I hope the American people, both your listeners and viewers and readers all over this country, realize how much opportunity, even though there are challenges, but how much opportunity this presents for them. You know, you say I covered the 89 fall of communism, the dominoes that went down behind the Iron Curtain after the Berlin Wall fell. To be honest with you, I was first in New York when the Berlin Wall fell. I was a novice reporter at that time, and I remember so dramatically everybody here in New York, from the taxi drivers to the people at the rail stations to people on the streets, saying to each other, to me, did you see that wall come down? And it was just this thing that captured people's imaginations. Never could they have believed that communism, this bulwark that they had been raised against all their lives, could be crumbling so rapidly in front of their eyes. Fast forward to now, and particularly in the post 9/11 world, where Americans have asked justifiably, where have the moderates been? What is it with the Islamic world? Is there a war by Islam against the West, against the United States, and vice versa in the Islamic world? Is the United States at war with us? Well, from January, in fact, from last December in Tunisia, to January in Egypt, and March and February in Libya and in Syria, these people are now standing up to be counted. And it is remarkable. It's young people and also the older ones who are coming out. But it's driven by the young people who are connected, who want to have democracy, accountable government, and to see a brighter future. It's an amazing moment.
Do you think the parallels between 1989 and this year say something about human nature? You know, Martin Luther King said, the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice. And I know there's a lot of horribleness in the world today that's leaving a lot of people cynical, but I see this as one of those years that renews my faith in King's idea. Have you thought about this year in anything like those terms?
Do you know, I have. And, Brian, I believe in that throughout all, as you say, the horribleness that we've witnessed and that I've certainly covered for the last 20-odd years. I believe in the essential desire of humankind to live a decent life and to want the kinds of things that we all want, the universal rights and justice. And frankly, wherever I go in the world, people talk to me about justice. They use that word, social justice. The other word they use is dignity. So that is the inevitable, the ineffable arc of human history. And I strongly, strongly, strongly believe that. And I remember, I was a novice reporter, let me just say it again, when the Berlin Wall came down. I went to Romania, actually. That was one of the first places I went. And people were sort of amazed that this was happening. Then the dictator Ceausescu was one of the worst in Eastern Europe, and the fall of Romania was the bloodiest and the most violent. But I remember thinking then that what communism was anti-human. It was against human nature because it took away the idea of justice. It took away the idea of people's individual lust for a better world, not just in terms of material gain for themselves, but to see a dignity for themselves and to see their personhood respected. And so I strongly believe that. And I do believe, although it's different, what's happening in the Islamic world, particularly the Arab world right now, is a continuation of that arc. And I strongly believe it is going to work out for their benefit and for the benefit of the rest of the world.
ABC This Week host Christian Amanpour. Do you know the name Mohammed Bouazizi?
Do I know that name? I certainly do. And so do, I hope, everybody knows that name. One man who, by setting himself on fire, by protesting the fundamental inequality, the unfairness of how the police were trying to deal with his little food stall in Tunisia, launched this revolution. And it is remarkable how one person often can just be the spark. I mean, literally in this case, but in general, the moral and the activist spark. Do you remember, Brian, back in 1989 when Tiananmen Square was raging, one man stood in front of that tank.
Yes, and that became the image that was remembered after it was seen around the world for all the years after. If I was Time Magazine, Mohamed Bouazizi would be my person of the year. He died on January 4th after setting himself on fire to protest that confiscation of his street vendor cart by city officials in Tunisia. And what do you think about the role of the individual, like Bouazizi, in movements like this, as opposed to a certain inevitability of history?
I think this is partly inevitable, but it's always the individual, and perhaps even the group. But it usually starts with the individual, whether it was in Tunisia, whether it was in Egypt. If you remember, it was the death of a particular young protester that galvanized, even before we were all aware of it, that galvanized his online community. And so it was that sort of individual. But I do think the group also is very important. And we saw that in Iran, for instance, in 2009. That would have been perhaps the first of the uprisings in that part of the world, had the Iranians stayed on the street and had the people not decided to use all means, rather the government, decided not to use all means necessary to keep themselves in power. Mm. There comes a time when people have had enough. And you can see it in innumerable places. Even let's just flip the tape back and go back to the Bosnian War, which I covered so extensively. And you remember at the time the dictatorship in Serbia of Slobodan Milosevic. Well, right after the war, right after Kosovo, the people came out into the streets and created their own democratic revolution in Serbia, got rid of Slobodan Milosevic after the entire 90s in which he perpetrated this genocide, this ethnic cleansing, this anti-democratic, anti-human, inhuman campaign in that part of the world. Finally, the people said, enough. Enough. We want to be counted. We do not want to go down in history on the side of this dictator.
There's Burma, Myanmar. Suddenly that close society is inching toward democracy. Did you notice that even in Russia there was a 10,000-person protest reported the other day?
Absolutely, and it's going on. I mean, look, the notion of the uprising or the spring is now catching fire. And whether or not it does, certainly the leaders are on notice, and they're afraid. In Russia, they're afraid. They think there may be a Russian winter spring, like what happened in the Arab Spring this time last year. And I, again, go back to Iran. They have been terrified for years about a velvet revolution, the kind of revolutions that toppled the dictatorships behind the Iron Curtain. And so all of these things play on the fears of the leaders, but also tend to galvanize the people. Again, you talk about the individual. Aung San Suu Kyi has spent the better part of the last two decades crusading for democracy, having won an election in 91, having been denied the ability to form a democratic government, having spent the better part of 15 years under house arrest. And now here she is, really guiding her country. Imagine this, almost giving space to these military rulers to allow them the chance to do the right thing. It's Aung San Suu Kyi who has told President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton that it's okay to engage. Now, they probably wanted to engage. There's a lot of economic opportunity in that part of the world. But she provided the green light, and it's fascinating to see how that's going to go. But let me also say that when the leaders are in prison or under house arrest, it is the foot soldiers who take the risks. We saw that in Burma. We saw the Saffron Revolution that tried to be but wasn't. The people came out onto the streets. They took their courage and their lives into their own hands and stood up to be counted. So it's leadership, but it's also the people who are willing to follow them and willing to risk the most terrible, terrible violence and to commit the most breathtaking bravery. It's humbling.
Absolutely. And then there's the complicated question of what has happened in the West. Occupy Wall Street, of course, but also there were the riots in England last summer and riots in Greece over the austerity measures and their financial crisis. I don't want to make facile connections. With your experience around the world, how much do you see connections between all these things and the Arab youth movements?
Well, I do see connections, and I also don't want to be facile about it, but I do see connections. And the connection is that people as a whole are feeling this pain. Now, the pain comes in different ways. It's political pain coupled with economic pain in the Arab world. It's austerity and the bad economy in the Western world, and a sense also that people feel that their voice is not being heard. Even in our democracies, they feel their voice is not being heard. For instance, in some of the European countries, and also, I suppose, and I do believe so, in the Occupy Wall Street movement as well, because, you know, there is a real sense that those who are in positions of power perpetuate their power and their wealth, and those who are not and who don't have that opportunity find it harder and harder to put their feet from one rung of the ladder to the next. I came to the United States, you know, more than 30 years ago, first to university and then to start my career. I did it for a reason. I came here out of the Iranian Revolution, but knowing that if you work hard, you have a dream, America is the land of opportunity. This is the land of the middle class, where you can do your best and strive, and if you're really lucky, you can achieve. Now, I have my son. I'm very worried that he won't be able to have a better standard of living than I do, which is the middle class dream. It's the American dream.
Yes.
And I think so many people, not only us who come from abroad, but people who've been born and raised and are Americans who grew up here, are feeling that anxiety, and I understand it.
Christiane Amanpour, my guest on WNYC. And as we look at the change around the world, you have gotten the chance to interview some of the thugs, including Gaddafi this year in February. We're going to play a 30-second clip of that. Gaddafi's voice is first here through a translator.
No demonstration at all in the streets. No one against us. Against me for what? Because I am not president.
But then
they love me, all my people with me. They love me, all.
But if they do love
me, they will die to protect me, my people.
If you say they do love you, then why are they capturing Benghazi and they say they're against you there? Why are they in Zawiya?
It is Gaida, not my people. It is Gaida. Gaida, yes.
And my apologies, that was Gaddafi, obviously, in his own voice speaking English. He had one of his aides translating, in effect, Al-Qaeda at the end to say what he was saying about who he was trying to blame for the uprising in Libya. How do you prepare, Christiane, to interview a 40-year dictator like Muammar Gaddafi as a pro-democracy revolution is taking shape around him?
Well, look, a lot of experience, and I think this is where experience amongst us journalists comes into play and is most valuable because, you know, we go out there and we pursue the work that we've been covering and witnessing in these countries over the last decade so that we're able to follow the trajectory of this particular history. I did so also in Egypt when I interviewed President Mubarak, or I got to him where nobody else could, and I do believe that's because, you know, they knew me, certainly from my CNN days, CNN International. These people all watched as we reported the news year after year.
But knowing you, why do you think, from Gaddafi's perspective, that he chose to sit with you? He certainly didn't expect you to be soft on him, did he?
No, he didn't. Sometimes I wonder why they open those doors. But I think also, again, it's human nature. I think those who are beleaguered sometimes recognize a not friendly but a recognizable face, and they do open the door, and then it's our opportunity to put the tough questions to him. But you know, you heard what he said. The man was, you know, I mean, deranged is perhaps too difficult a word to use, but most certainly in denial, a catastrophic denial that absolutely forbid him from recognizing what was going on around him. How could he tell me that my people love me? How could he tell me that they would die to save him? It was just the most extraordinary eyewitness and face-to-face with this kind of dictatorship that takes you out of the realm of reality. I don't believe he was always like that. He probably was a young, ambitious, fairly smart young colonel when he came to power, but the sitting there and hearing everybody tell you yes and everybody laughing at your jokes and nobody standing up against you for that long has a real effect. And I will say that Mubarak was different. Mubarak recognized what was happening. Mubarak stood down after 18 days of his people protesting in Tahrir Square. And when I saw him, he told me he knew the gig was up. He just wanted to make the transition, you know, a little bit more lengthy, and he didn't get that opportunity. People wanted him out. But he knew what was going on around him.
Having grown up in Iran and England, then lived here as long as you have and covered the world as a foreign correspondent, do you think Americans expect different things from you as a journalist, from journalism in general, reporting on government, than people elsewhere do? Not to pass judgment on any society, just to describe different expectations, if you think there are any.
I do think there are different I think there are different realities. I think certainly I've spent my career being tough on dictators and trying my best to stand up against and to confront unspeakable crimes, most particularly the worst crimes under international law, violations of human rights, but also crimes against humanity, war crimes, genocide, ethnic cleansing. You know, it wasn't easy when I started out. We were accused of having lost our objectivity because I suppose people expected us to have some kind of moral equivalency or to draw some kind of moral equivalency where, in fact, none existed. I determined in Bosnia that I would not make a parallel between the victim and the aggressor, that I would seek the truth and tell the truth no matter how difficult it was. And it was difficult, Brian. It was difficult. I had to endure my colleagues, some of them, certainly public officials, certainly world leaders, not wanting to hear that. I understand that. It's difficult. It's difficult to tell the truth. But that is our obligation as journalists. And if we don't do that, then I don't believe we're adding to the public debate. We're simply platforms and megaphones. And, you know, I don't think we do our job if we're not prepared, A, to be disliked or not to want to be liked in order to tell the truth. And I think that that is something I've really learned in this, you know, 20-plus year odyssey.
Is the Sunday morning talk show much different from being the chief foreign correspondent?
It is very different.
In that respect?
It is very different. I mean, there is more of a sense of a sort of an insider's club. I try to work against that because, of course, I'm not American. And I do look at this from a different perspective. And I find it fascinating. I find the politics here fascinating. I spent my whole career covering, you know, American policy as manifested abroad, mostly foreign policy. But now I'm covering American politics and policy from sort of an inside perspective. I'm not an insider, but getting a view, a more of a ringside view. And it's a very interesting experience. It's a massive learning curve, of course, for me. And I'm proud to be on this learning curve and to really be trying to figure out this democracy here. But I think democracies all over are facing challenges. So in that regard, I don't think it's that different.
Christiane Amanpour hosts ABC This Week every Sunday morning. Thank you so much for talking with us about this year. We'll be watching you next year on Sunday mornings.
Thank you very much, Brian.
Actually, we'll be watching her next year on ABC and CNN as she returns to international reporting for both networks. That was announced after our interview. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Up next, we continue to interview the interviewers all this morning. Tom Brokaw.